You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
How do you go about being thoughtful? What do you do? Every time I try, I only make things worse. Is there some particular method of being thoughtful that works every time?
Everybody, and welcome to episode 183 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Richard Winters from Scopophilia to discuss a 1989 film that is part 80s slasher, part 90s thriller, with a little bit of a baseball twist. Starring Roy Scheider, Karen Young, and Richard Bradford, directed by Peter Masterson. It's Night Game. But first...
Yes, everywhere you go, people talk about...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time, soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
When Satan goes wild, so does the night child.
Only this way will we always be together.
Possessed into the darkest kind of evil. Once the devil takes hold, every man take cover from the night child.
Sometimes I can read people's minds. Michael, you're in mortal danger.
Oh,
One day, she was an innocent little girl. One night, she became something else.
Stupid!
And God help us all. Keep saying to yourself, she's just a child. She's just a child.
I love her, and she scared me to death.
But this is the child of hell. Beyond the darkness, beyond the devil, watch out for the night child.
How long have you had this?
About 3 days.
It has been 400 years since its last reincarnation.
Any pain?
It kind of moves sometimes.
The soul of black magic is waiting to be reborn.
What's your diagnosis?
Anna! Richie Salatu.
For years, man has turned his back on the supernatural.
This is hers!
Might almost describe it,
Some will deny it.
As a fetus.
Others will fear it.
On her neck?
One woman will give birth to it. The Manitou. Since the beginning of time, it has practiced the mysterious arts. Its day is near. Each hour it grows stronger. Soon it will come. The Manitou. Starring Tony Curtis on a supernatural journey into the world of avenging spirits.
John!
Michael Ansara.
What does a white man want with Indian magic?
A modern American Indian thrust into a savage struggle with unspeakable taboos. Susan Strasberg, living in a nightmare. Innocent people, tormented by terror, threatened by the unknown. Trapped by an ancient horror, the Manitou. An evil that never dies. It just waits to be reborn. The Manitou.
And now, on with the show.
Denise Dix, have you ever heard of her?
No, I haven't.
Oh, thank you. You and Phil were married in Houston, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
At?
St. Anthony's Church.
When?
On the 4th of July.
No, I mean, what time of day?
In the afternoon, and then we left.
You left?
Well, we drove straight to the airport. We went to Cancun and spent our honeymoon there for the weekend. But Sal had to be back on Monday morning to train with the trainer. His shoulder was bothering him.
So you didn't spend the night of the 4th in Houston?
No.
Have you gotten anything in the mail that's like, you know, strange little pieces of paper, notes, things that say, best of luck, stay well, anything like that?
Phil mentioned some weird notes that came in through his fan mail once, but they gave it to the team officials and they turned it over to the police. It turned out to be this really wild girl who was really hot for my husband.
He didn't say what was in them.
No, he doesn't like to worry me.
I can understand why. Well, thanks for the iced tea.
Oh, this is a beautiful moment.
Oh, no. I had my hands over my head. I thought I might get hit by the bat.
Was this taken outside the church?
Yeah, it was right before we got in the limousine.
Yeah, McCann, Lazaro, Davis, and who's the shy guy?
Where?
Right there.
I don't know. I've never noticed before.
Could I borrow this?
Why?
Well, Denise Dixon was murdered behind this church on the 4th of July. Just for a couple of days.
All right. But I'll have to tell Sil.
Okay, our movie this time is Night Game from 1989. And joining me to discuss this film is Richard Winters from Scopophilia. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's been a while, but it's always fun. So thank you for inviting me back.
Yeah. It has been a while. And in fact, I was thinking about today. You've been on the show several times, but going way back, you were actually my guest on the second ever episode of this show, and now here we are 180 some episodes later, so it's great to have you back again, and I'm thrilled that I don't think I messed up the name of your site too much. But for the folks that have not heard you on the show before, remind everybody of who you are and what you do over there at your site.
Well, it's Scopophilia. It's Greek for the love to look. And we have an eye for the icon, and it's movies of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I'm thinking me and you, we're one of the older bloggers now. We both started in 2011, if you can believe it. So 12 years is supposed to be a long time, but for blogging at least.
Yeah. It's getting shorter all the time. I tell you, the older I get, the quicker time flies.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. But, yeah, we review movies in the 70s and 80s, and I'm trying to get all of them. So I got another 10 years at least to go. But we got 1,806 movies reviewed so far.
Oh, awesome.
So, and I like it. We're getting a lot of reoccurring commenters on there. So I think people do enjoy it, and especially people that have lived in that era or just have some nostalgia for that era. It's the movies back then are way different than today, so it's just a lot of fun to watch movies when they weren't so bound by all the stuff they're bound by today. So it's just kind of a fun. I think it brings back memories of your childhood, and that's why I kind of like watching older movies. I don't know about you, but
well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love revisiting that stuff that I grew up on, and also seeing the stuff that I maybe missed back in the time, and you know. The more I get into film, the more I find myself just being intrigued with all the different aspects. I've talked about it before on this show that if it weren't for this adventure of blogging and podcasting, you know, I might not have never discovered things like pre-code cinema or certain areas of silent cinema, you know, all kinds of different things. So, you know, it's great to just get a well-rounded view of movies for sure. But as far as those three decades that you cover, I mean, I got to admit a fondness for them as well. But I mean, beyond just nostalgia and stuff, I mean, what is it about that time frame, the 60s, 70s and 80s, 30 years there? What about that era of film resonates so much with you?
Well, I think the main thing is they were breaking, you know, talk about breaking the barriers. I mean, every movie that came out then was a fresh idea. Now we get movies that are remakes of movies from that period. But then we still had fresh ideas. Everything was new and quite, in some cases, just downright outrageous. I mean, there's stuff you'll see in 70s, 80s movies they wouldn't dare make today. So it's just kind of watching stuff when creativity was really out there and there weren't really any bounds, you know. And I think that kind of made it more inventive than today when, you know, everything's got to be kind of contained. And also no computerized effects. I actually like seeing a car really blowing up. I don't want the computer animated, which to me always looks fake. It's getting better, but it's still fake. At least with older movies, those special effects were much, they were real stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. It's wonderful to watch some of these older movies, especially when you said that, I kind of thought back to like Australian Ozploitation yes. movies from the 70s and such. And you see these wild car crashes and stunts and things like that. And you go, somebody really did that. You know, that's amazing.
The Cars That Ate Paris is a very famous one from Australia where these gang takes over this town. These cars take over this whole town. So, there's a lot of... And Mad Max is another one, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you kind of, as you're going across these three decades, I mean, is there, just something that you just really go, oh, I'm so glad I get to experience another film of this sort, you know, from this era? Like, you know, I think about, like, for example, the 60s, you know, this is a little cheesy, but I have a real sweet spot when it comes to like the AIP movies and the beach party movies and things like that. Or, you know, I think about different things that are kind of like hallmarks of each of those decades. Are you kind of the same way with that?
Yeah. Because they're very unique. You can, within probably 2 minutes, you can tell what the decade is that this movie, even if you don't know anything else about the movie, just the filming style, the look of it. You could probably pinpoint the decade it came from, which is always kind of the coolest thing. But, I like a lot of different genres, though. It would be hard to pick one. But, you probably, even if we were stymied to just watching 70s movies for the rest of our lives, there would be enough variety there. It could still satisfy probably anybody, in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I think one of the cool things about your site is I continually see you posting about movies that I'm just going, wow, I haven't heard of that before, or I've heard of that, but I have never been able to find it. I mean, you hit on some stuff that is pretty hard to find. So, what's your secret?
You gotta dig. You gotta dig. You know, there is a lady. She lives in Israel. She's called the DVD lady. She has just about every obscure movie you could think of. I mean, literally, she's a major collector, and she will agree for a fee to send you a copy of just about. And her copies are very good. If you ever want to look, I suggest DVDlady.com. She's a very nice lady too. She's very prompt and I get a lot of movies from her that just are nowhere. I don't know where she gets them, but that's one of the major ones. Yeah,
we probably don't want to know where they get them from.
Yeah. Well, she's outside of the U.S., so she doesn't have to worry about the copyright law and all that.
So they say, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get on with this movie here today. Okay. So this is Night Game from 1989. It's directed by Peter Masterson. Now, he's had a long and diverse career. He's worn a lot of hats in the movies over the ages, worked as an actor. And if you look through his filmography, you'll see some pretty notable films that he's been in. He was in stuff like In the Heat of the Night. He's in The Stepford Wives. He's in The Exorcist. So this guy's had, quite an acting career. Also, he's been a writer. He actually co-wrote the musical The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. That's pretty wild. And then he's had a whole nother career as a director. Nothing terribly big, but a few notable films. I did notice probably the most notable on his filmography as a director is The Trip to Bountiful, which, of course, Geraldine Page won a Best Actress Oscar for.
A Texas movie, too.
He also did a film called Full Moon in Blue Water, which it just so happens I picked up a copy of this recently at my favorite used DVD store. It's got Gene Hackman and Terry Garr, and so that's in my future. He also directed a film called Lost Junction with Nev Campbell, which is another one that I just happened to pick up at the used DVD store. Had no idea that we were going to be talking about this director, but apparently he's got some power over me because I just randomly pulled a couple of his movies off the shelf recently. So we'll see. Also, if his last name sounds familiar, it's because he is also the father of actress Mary Stuart Masterson. So
good actress, too. Yeah, I like her.
So now this film, it takes place primarily in Galveston, Texas, where there have been a string of murders happening. Young blonde women slashed with some sort of sharp weapon that appears to be a hook of some sort. So grisly murders going on. On the case is a police detective named Mike Seaver, played by Roy Scheider. Now, I got to say, just a little aside here, this threw me a bit because the name Mike Seaver, I was like, that was the name of Kirk Cameron's character on Growing Pains for many years. In fact, that show was still running at the time this movie was made. So that was just strange. Anyway, so Seaver, he's had some kind of a troubled past. He's also got a history. He was a minor league baseball player at one point. But currently, he's, working for this kind of small police department. He's dating a girl named Roxy, who's played by Karen Young, who is some 20 years plus younger than him. And it shows, okay? To kind of give you an idea of the age difference here, another little aside, okay? So Roy Scheider, of course, famously played Chief Brody in Jaws. Karen Young, his love interest in this movie, a few years before this film, played his daughter-in-law, Carla Brody, in Jaws the Revenge. Yeah, a little weird there. All right, so anyway, so Seaver, he's investigating a bunch of different angles of these crimes going on, but doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. One of the girls was a hooker, so he's checking out names in her little black book, etc. Meanwhile, there's a rival detective played by Paul Gleason, who is causing him trouble. Eventually, though, Seaver discovers that one of the murders took place behind a church where earlier that same day, a young up-and-coming pitcher for the Houston Astros got married. And so then he gradually starts to realize that the murders are somehow tied to when this pitcher gets a win in a home game at the Astrodome. And as things go on, then, of course, Seaver's girlfriend, Roxy, ends up being a potential victim for the killer, as these movies tend to go. So it's a thriller with a bit of a baseball connection. I admit I'm a bit of a sucker for baseball movies, but I don't know. Maybe it's a little stretch to call it a baseball movie. But I'm going to let Richard start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Night Game.
Well, first of all, you mentioned Full Moon and Blue Water, that Masterson had also done that. And there's a quick scene where he drops her off. Roy Scheider drops his girlfriend off at the theater, and they're playing Full Moon and Blue Water. That was on the marquee. So
I love Easter eggs like that. Yeah, that's great.
Well, first of all, it's an easy-to-follow mystery. I was a little tired. You know, some mysteries, there's too many clues, too many red herrings, and it just gets confused. This is actually kind of simple. You know, it's not too many clues that gets overloaded. I did kind of like the way they portrayed police work, how it is very tough. You know, you get this murder and just a few little clues and you have to really research stuff. It is dated though, because they show the inside of a police department. There's no computers. Everything is just paperwork. So, you know, you saw how they did it. I really enjoyed Richard Bradford, the white-haired guy. He is really funny as this super nervous, stressed-out police chief. And I think they cast him to help make Roy Scheider look younger, because Roy was already in his late 50s. And so having this gray-haired guy that seems overwhelmed helped make Roy Scheider seem like he had more energy. So I think that was intentional. You know, I don't know how, you know, again, most guys in their 50s, the dream is to get a 24-year-old girl, but I don't know. Yeah, it didn't make a lot of sense, a huge age difference or why she was attracted to him. Plus, the mother that played the fiancé's mother, she looked too young to have a woman that was 24. I thought it would work better if her mother was Roy's age and looked at, and she was jealous of her daughter dating Roy because she wanted Roy for herself, kind of like the graduate, but reverse.
I got the impression that maybe that was an angle it was going, but that I don't know if stuff got left on the cutting room floor or something, because there was a kind of a throwaway line where she says something about having known him when they were in high school. And I even got the impression like they may have dated a bit. And so it's like he's suddenly now engaged to the daughter of a girl he dated in high school. So that was a little odd, but I agree. She looks much younger than Roy Scheider does.
Right. And it would have enlivened it if there had been more of a conflict there. Because the only conflict is he brings home a TV, plops it on her microwave oven. That's a very odd place to put a TV. And she doesn't like the TV. And that's another problem, too. That kind of, even in the third act, you know, in a thriller, by the third act, we're supposed to be just only interested in the mystery, because by that time we're captured enough. That's all we wanted to see is figuring out the mystery. But instead, there's a long scene, even in the third act, where they're kind of arguing about the TV, and he says, well, leave it out at the front door. I'll pick it up. But I thought that was too late to be droning on about something that's not real consequential to the actual story. So,
yeah, I think you're right about that. At the same time, I did find it kind of charming that throughout this film, there are these little, I guess, asides that just kind of, I don't know, paint a bigger picture of this community, and that, you know, it's not just police work for this guy, but that we see other elements of his life. And I actually think that the bickering that goes on between him and the mother does make for some funny sequences. There's another sequence, a lot like the television sequence, where they're at the bridal shop and picking out a wedding dress, and there's this bickering going on about the wedding dress, and you know, there needs to be a dress with a train and all this stuff. And, you know, I just thought there were some great little funny asides in that. And the actress that plays the mother here, I thought she was a lot of fun. Her name is Carlin Glynn, and she looked very familiar. I wasn't sure. You know, I've probably seen her in other things. But again, as I researched, she's the director's wife and thus the mother of Mary Stuart Masterson.
So, okay, that's why she got cast in the part, even though she didn't look really old enough to be the mother. But, you know, when you know the director, that helps. So.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this film was pretty enjoyable for the most part. I mean, it didn't blow me away. But I thought it was a pretty solid, like you say, simple kind of thriller. And I, you know, as I was kind of thinking about where it falls here, you know, in terms of where it was released and what different elements we see in this film are, I kind of saw it as like a bridge between like the 80s slasher movies, because there's certainly a slasher element to this, and then like the 90s thrillers. I mean, I was thinking like if this had been made, oh, I don't know, 3-4 years further down the road in the 90s, I think they would have changed it around, made it more of a quote-unquote erotic thriller. There's not really an erotic element to it, but you can see where this is kind of filling in the gaps between those slashers of the 80s and the erotic thrillers of the 90s.
It is very I was surprised how graphic it is, because there's a scene where they're looking at the pictures of the victims, and it's like real close up to their wounds. It's pretty bloody. And I was going like, because most thrillers don't get quite so graphic because they're going for a different type of audience than the slasher fans. So I was thinking that was kind of, I don't know, seemed a little out of place.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It caught me off guard too. I mean, the film is, I'm more graphic than I expected it to be.
Yes.
You know, the kills certainly have a graphic element. We could talk about that more here in a moment, but I mean, definitely the most graphic moment of the film is that scene you're talking about where, you know, you've got these police officers, the detectives and the stressed out chief and all that. And they're in this room, this cramped room, and they're watching slides of the different injuries, the different wounds to the previous victims. And yeah, they are really graphic photos. And as a matter of fact, you know, I mean, looking at them, I was like, that's either some of the best makeup I've ever seen, or those are actual crime scene photos.
And then one of the policemen does run out. He gets sick, but I thought more of them should have run out. I might have run out looking at all that. But yeah, and then let's see. I did, you know, talk about funny banter. I did like that Cheryl that was like the receptionist at the police station. And
oh, Rose, yeah.
Yeah, so what's the score? She says 7-4. She says, well, who won? I don't know that. I don't follow sports. You're just like I even knew the score. And he gets, but I know people like that at work. They don't follow the sports or whatever. And, you know, you get that sometimes. So
she had a great dynamic, too, with the chief.
Yes.
Yeah, the actor you were mentioning earlier, Richard Bradford,
yeah.
Who, you know, I agree. I thought he was a lot of fun in this. I loved his kind of the approach he was doing here. He's like, you know, supposed to be really stressed out and, you know, like he's always popping aspirin and stuff
yeah.
like that. And just seems like he's slightly overwhelmed with the whole thing and doesn't want to deal with Scheider and his stuff. He doesn't want to deal with Paul Gleason's stuff. You know, doesn't want to deal with Lane Smith, who's the governor's aide or whatever. He's just, you know, overworked, overstressed and such. And he's got a lot of really fun little lines, you know, that are, you know, just kind of that down home Texas kind of feel to them. And yeah, I thought he was the MVP. I loved his performance. I thought he was very funny. And it's another one of those cases where I'm watching the actor and going, oh, he's in Something I Know. And it was probably about, I don't know, 30 minutes into the movie, I realized, oh, he plays the main bad guy in The Legend of Billie Jean with Helen Slater, which, of course, was another Texas movie.
He was in Permanent Record, too, if you remember, with Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of a stretch that he could connect the murder. Every time this pitcher pitched a game, there was a murder, because technically, you know, in New York City, I think there's murders every day at somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah. You could easily say any pitcher when they pitch, there's a murder. That seemed like a stretch, and it lost credibility for me with that. There even
yeah.
needed to be more clues or something. The killer was leaving for them to figure that, because it didn't make sense. But
I agree. There was a big jump when they got to that, and you know, it's one of those things that you go, okay, well, it's certainly original. I can't say that I've seen that in other things, but I mean, based on the evidence we've seen in the movie here, do I really believe that you came to that conclusion all by yourself?
Yeah.
No, we're taking a bit of a leap there. And you know, I mean, it in some ways it opens up more questions than
yes.
you know, than anything else, because you're sitting there going, all right, well, why is it only home games? You know,
right.
what happens if the pitcher gets a save and not a win, you know? So it draws a lot of question marks there. But again, like I said, I'm kind of a sucker when it comes to movies that have a bit of a baseball theme to them. So I did enjoy aspects of it, but yeah, it's a leap.
You don't see a lot of baseball either. Just a few scenes in the Astrodome and that's it. The rest is the mystery. So it's not like, if you're really a big baseball fan, I don't think you're going to be totally satisfied with what they show, because they don't show too much. But
yeah, and I mean, they could have done more with it, too, because, I mean, like, you know, they talk about how Roy Scheider's character was once a minor league baseball player, and, you know, some of the other characters that he meets with at times, you know, reference his previous career with that. In general, that was just another aspect of the film where I thought it feels like there might have been more here, but it ended up on the cutting room floor, or they just couldn't go that far because of budget or time constraints or I don't know what. You know, because there's also like a brief hint that Scheider's father had mob connections or something like that, and you know, there's a checkered past there, you know, so yeah, just again, a lot of question marks with some of that stuff.
And if you're not, I don't, can we go into who the culprit was? Or
oh, absolutely. Yeah, we don't shy away from spoilers on this show.
But that didn't make any sense too, because supposedly the guy was upset because he got cut from the team and this other pitcher replaced him. So he was killing these women to supposedly get back at the pitcher, but that didn't make that's not going to bother the pitcher. You're killing some random strange women that he doesn't know. I would think to get back at the pitcher, you should threaten him or threaten his family or threaten the general manager, the coach, or the coach. That would seem to make more sense if you want revenge against the team that cut you. Or am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I think that the film lays some groundwork that you think is going to take it in that direction, and then it doesn't, because there's that whole moment where Roy Scheider is starting to kind of, you know, get an idea that this might be somehow connected to what the baseball player does. He goes and visits the pitcher's newlywed wife, you know, and he's asking her questions about things. And I'm thinking, all right, well, maybe she's going to become the next victim here. Or, you know, we're going to see that character move on in some other way. But nope, that's not the way it goes.
And I would have done it differently. I would have had the thriller where we know up front it's just disgruntled pitcher, and he's attacked, you know, has threatened to attack anybody on the team, even the family members of the teammates, you know, children, wives, he may attack them. And so the tension comes, who's next? Who, you know, the police can't protect everybody all the time. So who's next that he's going to lash out at? You know, maybe say he's real cagey, he's hard to track, he's in hiding, so I don't know where he is. To me, that would be more thrilling, more exciting, more original. This thing kind of took the old-fashioned slasher formula approach, and outside of just that extreme tangent of connecting, you know, the murder happens every time a pitcher wins the game. Other than that, it's very basic, and there's not a lot of originality to it. And I think they could have done it differently. But
Yeah. And, I mean, even that slasher element of it, I mean, you know, if you think about other slashers, we kind of know who the killer is a lot of times. You know, in many cases is a masked killer, you know. I mean, whether that's, you know, Jason or Michael Myers or Ghostface or whatever, okay. But still, we have a sense of who the killer is, what his weapons are, beyond just it being this shadowy figure. And in this film, they approach the kills in different ways at different times, but we don't really get a sense of, you know, what kind of a threat we're dealing with here. The first kill we see in the movie is kind of your traditional POV of the killer type of thing,
right?
Where he encounters, you know, the hooker on the beach. And in fact, that's another prime example where I'm going, was there more that they cut out? Because when he sneaks up on her, she turns around.
She knows him.
She sounds like she knows him. Yeah. She recognizes him.
What's you? What do you want? Yeah. What? Yeah.
And that's never pursued in any way.
Right.
And then, you know, as things go on, we do get some other interesting kills, I would say. The one that I really liked was the House of Mirrors sequence, where, you know, they're at an amusement park, and there are these two girls in there, and the killer goes in, and you know, we get all this stuff going on with the mirrors and such. And the thing that's cool about it is we actually do see the killer in that moment. But because it's this House of Mirrors and we've got these carnival mirrors that do all the distortion and stuff, we get this weird distorted look at him. So even though we see his face, we don't really see his face. So it's almost like doing the masked killer thing, but because they're playing with the image, so to speak, you know. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's probably the only interesting. It's kind of like The Lady of Shanghai. That's a famous movie where it ended with the House of Mirrors. So it's kind of similar to that, although a poor cousin to it.
Or Enter the Dragon, too, yeah.
Yeah, that's another one. The only problem is, too, when we finally do see the killer in real life, he does not look like a guy who ever played baseball or was ever an athlete. Like out of shape, beer guzzling truck driver. All apologies to truck drivers, but definitely not it. So that looked kind of phony, too, I felt.
Yeah. No, it was, he did not look like he was, you know, just cut from the team recently, by any stretch of the imagination.
He'd never get on a team ever with that shape he was in. That's, you know.
Jumping back real quick before we leave the House of Mirrors too much, I have to mention, because as I was researching the film, I totally missed it as I was watching the movie. But the actress who first gets killed, two actresses get killed in that sequence. But the first one is a recognizable person for many people. So the first victim in that scene is played by Renee O'Connor, who is most famous to folks for playing Gabrielle on Xena the Warrior Princess.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. But yeah, I'm moving on from that scene, though. I guess the other kind of centerpiece, moment with the killer chasing someone down is a little later in the film where a woman runs into a construction site and it's and the killer is chasing her. And
yeah.
I thought there were some good things with that. It's kind of, it's a little bit of an eye roller because it plays into those horror movie tropes where you're going, why are you running upstairs? Why are you going there? There's going to be no escape, type of thing. Actually, the scene had my biggest wince moment of the whole thing. I mean, in a movie where we have people being slashed with hooks and stuff, she steps barefoot on a nail in that scene. And I was like, ooh, no.
She's able to keep running after that. The running would stop with most people after that. But...
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I was happy to at least, because initially she gets chased by a car. And I was going, why are you running in a straight line directly in front of the car? You need to veer off, get off the road. She eventually does, but that was kind of a dumb thing too. Talk about one of those, because you're not going to outrun a car, so don't just keep running on the road thinking you can outrun it. Get off the road, jump off the road, whatever you need to do. But that started a little bit like that too, where what are you thinking? But
yeah, and the car like burst through a wall or something like that. I thought it was pretty cool. Is this a construction site? And in general too, I mean, one of the things I liked about that we go into a construction site and some of the other places we talked about, like the House of Mirrors and stuff like that. I thought that one thing the film did really well is that it has a good use of locations. Yeah. I mean, this, like I said, it takes place in Galveston, Texas. I've never been to Galveston. It's an island. I know that.
Yeah.
And, it's only like about, 50 miles south of Houston?
It's actually
like that.
It's just 30.
Yeah, that's not very far at all. Yeah. I mean, it's basically a part of that metro area. But watching this movie, it feels like this kind of small, slightly quirky town. I mean, you've got these different like police characters who are, all these kind of slightly odd characters in there. You've got the carnival that's going on. That's where Roxy and her mother work, so you've got the carnival people and that's all a little bit quirky and such. And, I just thought that this film had a really good use of those locations and filling it with those kind of interesting side characters. I mean, really, the side characters are all really colorful. The most bland character in the whole thing is Roy Scheider.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I wish they had played up, because he had a conflict with Paul Gleason initially, another investigator, and that wasn't played up enough. I would have liked to see more. And then Lane Smith, he's such a great supporting actor, and he comes in kind of in the second act, and I thought that should have been planned. They should have been quarreling. Like, Lane had this idea of how they were going to do the investigation, and Roy had a different approach, and really having them fight on that. And they acted like it was coming, but there's no payoff to it. So I was disappointed.
While we're kind of on that subject, let's talk a bit about the performances here. I mean, we hinted on a few things. We both really liked Richard Bradford and such. But, let's talk Roy Scheider. He's the big star here. He's, he's our central character. What do you think about what Roy Scheider's bringing here?
I was, at the start, you see him without a shirt on, and when he goes to bed with his fiance, and you can tell he had wrinkled skin on his chest. So initially I was thinking, he's too old for this. But then he did, I think, because he was paired with Bradford, came off like kind of this old guy that's just too nervous anymore to do his job. He came up, because of that pairing, I think it did work. He came off like he was still kind of young when he paired him in the scene with the other guy. So it kind of worked, but I'm not surprised. I think Scheider's starring career ended after this, because after this, then he did TV shows. He was in that TV show, what was it, Sequest or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and whenever a leading actor in a movie has to just start starring in a TV show, that usually means it's a decline, that they're no longer getting the offers they want, and now they have to go down to TV.
back in the era when this movie was made, certainly not as much anymore.
But it's a little different now.
No, I mean, I guess as I watched this, I was just kind of going, well, you know, I mean, Scheider's fine in this. You know, I was like, it's not anything spectacular. He's not giving it the same kind of gusto he's given in a movie like Jaws or All That Jazz or something like that.
But
you know,
great man.
Phenomenal. I mean, this is a case where, yes, he's collecting a paycheck, but I don't think I could say he's phoning it in either. He's giving it a valiant effort. It's just not quite. I mean, for one thing, it's not the sort of material of that other stuff when he was Roy Scheider. You know what I mean? It's
right. The script didn't give him much to do anyway. So yeah, it's not his fault totally.
I did like his leading lady. I like Karen Young in this. I think, again, it's weird just the dynamic. You know that he's so much older than her. When they first show up, I was kind of like, I mean, literally the first time you see her on screen with Scheider, which is just a few minutes into the film, you go, oh my goodness, she's way too young for him. And you're thinking, this is one of those classic cases of, well, I'm the leading man and I can have whatever woman I want type of a thing. You know, but I did like that the fact that there was this age difference played into the story and you know, wasn't something that we just go, oh, well, that's just the way it is. You know, it was an element of these characters. So I like that. And I thought she had a kind of fun, playful, somewhat quirkiness to her. I mean, it's actually funny, you know, again, going back to the director of this film, the more I thought about it, I was like, well, she's very much a Mary Stuart Masterson type in this. So it's kind of strange who the director is here.
Well, but the only thing, too, I thought at the end, you know, the final victim that the killer goes after is his fiance. But how convenient. That seemed to, it was way too coincidental that he just kind of ran into her when he was looking for somebody. To me, that's another thing that just kind of ruined it for me. Too cliched.
Well, and I tell you, I knew that was coming. After the very first murder that we see, because the way that the film is structured, we basically get a little bit of an intro over the credits. So that's setting up the baseball angle. Then we go to Scheider and his fiance, you know, they've just gotten engaged. It's romantic, all that stuff. And then we go and we see the first murder where the hooker is on the beach and the guy comes up to her and all that. And as soon as that scene happened, I thought, the third act is going to be that girl we just saw with Scheider. She's going to be the potential victim. And I guess I've just seen too many movies because I was 100% right.
I didn't like the beach scene. I mean, it's, you know, Galveston has a pretty beach, but you know, the murder victim is on the beach and you have the head detective, Richard Bradford, concerned about the publicity. And all that does is remind you of a far better Roy Scheider movie, Jaws, which, you know, and I don't think it's good for movies to do that because it just reminds you of a way better movie. And then you wish, gee, I wish I was sitting there watching that movie instead of this dumb thing. And that was kind of a mistake by the director.
Before we move into the break, too, I kind of skipped over this. So we were talking about the, you know, the kills and such. But what do you think of the murder weapon itself? Because we're throwing a little bit of a curveball, to use a baseball phrase with that, because the cops all think it's like a hook that would be used down on the docks and such. But it turns out to be a prosthetic hook, you know, that someone with one hand might wear.
I don't think they still give guys or people hooks anymore if they lose a limb, right? There, because it was a little cliche. Even then, I thought that was going out of style. You know, usually try to do something, but they didn't do enough of it because it was just one slash and they were dead. You know, if you really want to make it interesting, you gotta slash them more and have a little more creativity with the hook. Maybe with one person, he slashes the throat. With the other person, maybe he gouges the eye. Or, you know, don't just. It was just kind of this not very creative. It was a creative idea initially, but again, didn't go far enough with it because it was just one slash in the throat. We're done. Kind of after a while, the first killing is graphic and it is kind of interesting. And, you know, the room of mirrors is interesting too. But after that, it got kind of boring, the killings, just kind of robotic to me. So it lost its interest after that.
Well, and I thought it was kind of interesting, too. The more I thought about it, I was like, oh, the one-armed man did it.
Right, exactly. That's another thing, too, when there's that friend of his that's familiar with the case, they're at the Astros game, and his friend talks about, oh, well, there was this pitcher that got cut from the team, and then that day he was in a car accident and he got a hook in his hand. And that's when the light bulb goes off and Roy Scheider said, oh, I bet you he's the killer. But I would think the other guy, because the other guy was familiar with the case, too, I would think the light bulb would go off on his head, too. Everybody, yeah, I mean, it was just clear to everybody at that point who the killer was. So the idea that only Roy Scheider would be smart enough to figure out the connection when anyone else could have figured it out, too, by that point. So that seemed a little...
He's the former big city cop. He's smarter than all these small town.
Yeah.
All right. Before we go to the break here, I'll just give you one more shot for your any closing thoughts you have on this film.
It's okay, but I give it. We on my blog we have a 10-point scale, so I'd give it just 4 out of 10. To me, the only fun thing is getting to see the Astrodome because that's still in Houston. I was in Houston recently, but it's dwarfed by Reliant Stadium, which is right next to it. So it used to be considered the eighth wonder of the world, but not anymore. But still just interesting seeing the inside of it. And you do get a few good scenes inside, but that was probably one of the better highlights of the movie. Really.
Yeah. No, I thought that was neat to see. Yeah. I mean, I think the film it's no great shakes.
No.
It's perfectly, it's perfectly entertaining for just a night you want to veg out with something simple that's, you know, got some interesting aspects. It's not going to wow you at all, but, I thought it had some interesting things. And like you said at the beginning, it's a simple little kind of mystery thing. And I got to admit, when mysteries get too complex, my brain hurts. So I don't mind things to be simple every now and then, you know?
The payoff wasn't so great either, but yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top 3 lists.
Okay, yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it.
That's just how it works.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can help support the show and earn access to some great bonus features, including access to some of the early episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty, with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where myself and my guest each get to talk about another movie that we've really enjoyed, something we want to spread the word about. It might be a forgotten film. It could be an old classic or something that's new in theaters, something that's on streaming. It could be absolutely anything. So, Richard, what is your recommendation?
I was surprised by this. This is part of the Warner Archive Collection. That I got. It's a movie called Corky, C-O-R-K-Y. It stars Robert Blake, who just died not more than a few months ago. He plays a stock car driver, and he has a terrible attitude, to say the least. He's real reckless. It's kind of came out in 1972 when character studies about self-destructive people were very hip. We had Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson. This kind of follows that same formula. He's just restless, can't settle down, can't keep a stable relationship. He fools around a lot. He gets drunk a lot. And initially I thought, well, this is kind of boring because we've seen it all before. But the third act is really pretty good because he really self-destructs. I mean, in scary ways. He becomes a mass shooter and starts going back and shooting up the town, and he's totally without money. So it really is kind of an interesting film in that it shows you can't be a rebel all the time. He'll catch up to you at some point, and there can be some ugly ramifications. And Robert Blake is really good in this, and then Charlotte Rampling, who's still acting today. She's very young here, but she's good. And I'd say it was filmed here in Texas. And I would say if you're looking for something a little bit offbeat and has a very strong 70s flavor, that this would be worth checking out. It's on DVD. So
this is one I am familiar with. It. In fact, I've been considering picking it up on the Warner Archive DVD. I know some of the Warner Archive titles you can pay to stream on Amazon. This isn't one of them. You have to get the DVD.
Yeah.
Last time I looked, and I'm definitely intrigued by it. For one, I've always been intrigued by Robert Blake. I think mainly because I remember him first and foremost as being one of the Little Rascals. He's one of the last child actors to have been a part of the Our Gang series. And in fact, when he passed away a month or two ago, that left only one surviving member of the Little Rascals still alive. So I've always kind of been intrigued by just his history, going from doing those films as a child and then up through other child acting and into adult and, doing things like In Cold Blood and things like that. And especially in this era, Robert Blake was in some interesting films. I believe it's the following year, 1973, he's in Electric Glide in Blue, which is
brilliant.
Great movie. Yeah. Great movie. And, of course, I've tried to remember, I don't remember what year it is, but he's in Busting with Elliot Gould.
The second year, too. Yeah, I don't think you were a fan of that one, if I remember. I liked it, but I think you kind of had problems with it. But
I think I had some problems with it, but it's still it's got some interesting aspects to it. And, Elliot Gould is another one of those actors who I will watch in just about anything. So,
he's great.
I am intrigued by Corky for sure.
Robert Blake, he's a good, it's unfortunate he had those problems in real life that kind of tainted his career and his reputation, but really, he's a good actor. I mean, he is a good actor. If you give him a good script, he delivers,
He improved greatly because fans of the Our Gang series often cite him as being one of the least favorite of the Our Gang kids. But as an adult, he did much better. The movie that I'm going to recommend, you went with another Texas movie. I'm going with another Texas movie here as well. As I was thinking about things that we saw in Night Game, my brain kept going to the Astrodome. And so I am going to recommend Robert Altman's Brewster McCloud from 1970, the same year as MASH.
Yeah.
He had two movies in 1970, MASH, which is my favorite Altman film, and Brewster McCloud, which is really up there as well for me. And actually, there's quite a few people in Brewster McCloud that are in MASH. I mean, Bud Cort is the title character, but you've also got Sally Kellerman and Rene Auberjonois, John Shuck, Michael Murphy, bunch of MASH people are in Brewster McCloud. Plus Shelley Duvall making her film debut in this one. But I mean, basically, Bud Cort plays the title character. He is actually living in the Astrodome, where he is putting together a pair of wings, building these wings so he can fly. Kellerman is there as like his fairy godmother, guardian angel, something like that. And then they're also, not unlike the movie we talked about today, we have a murder plot going on and cops investigating and trying to figure out what's going on.
Bird poop to death.
There's a lot of bird poop in this movie too. But it's just got all the things that I like about a Robert Altman film. You know, it's got a quirky script, offbeat characters. The story in this I found quite charming. I mean, the conclusion with Bud Cort flying around the Astrodome on these wings, I mean, it's an impressive sequence. It's really, you were talking about how, you know, the Astrodome was considered the eighth wonder of the world. I mean, this sequence, seeing him flying around in there, you're just going, wow, that's pretty cool. I know Altman is not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. I like a lot of his stuff. And for me, Brewster McCloud is right up there with MASH and Nashville.
I'm glad to hear you say, because I was back when I lived in Indianapolis, we had a movie group. We would watch a different movie. Get this guy had his home theater in the basement of his home. We'd get together and a whole group of us movie fans, we'd watch a movie on the big screen in his home. And he showed Brewster McCloud, and unfortunately, I was the only one that came away liking it. They couldn't quite get into the quirkiness of it. But I'm glad here there's at least another fan, because I thought it was brilliant. But you're right. Not everybody likes Altman. That is true.
Thing I always remember about Brewster McCloud is the little, like, cutaway moments with Rene Auberjonois playing like a scientist or something, doing like a lecture about birds and such. it's an odd film, but I think really.
And you forgot talking about the cast. You forgot the most famous person, Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch from The Wizard of Oz. She is in this movie. She even swears. You hear her say a naughty word. And then Stacy Keach is in this. He was real young. He was only 30 when he did, but he plays this super old guy on a wheelchair and goes, an electrical wheelchair, and he goes cruising down the road in an electrical wheelchair. And that's actually, you won't recognize him, but that's actually Stacy Keach.
Yeah. Completely unrecognizable. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Richard, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all the projects you've got going on.
It's scopophiliamovieblog.com, movies of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And I will say, one of the things that also I love about your site, I didn't say this at the beginning, but I love seeing all the classic movie posters that you have.
Thank you.
All right, well, I'll be back to close the show here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Film Cast. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read other reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn more about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
match the Astros score?
I think 7-4.
7-4 who?
I don't know.
What inning?
I don't know.
Oh, this is beautiful. 2 weeks ago, they're 9 games behind L.A., and now it's down to 4, and you don't know the score? You're a wellspring of information, Cheryl.
Hey, I never played the game. You did. You should be thankful for 7-4.
I am, Cheryl. I am.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.